You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Brian Manser.
Welcome to Author Stories. I'm Hank, your host, and with me today is Steve Bollier, co-founder of Athon Books.
Hey, hey, how are you today?
So this week, Steve, we're doing something really fun. We have quite a few Athon authors who are releasing books right now. You guys are doing some of the best work in science fiction and fantasy right now. And through some conversations, we said, you know, why don't we do a showcase week where we showcase some of the new releases going on, let people get to know some of the Athon authors and see the quality of work that you guys are putting out. It's been about a year or a year and a half now. What's going on with Athon, Steve?
Well, it's technically, I guess, been about a year. We started in August of 2018. Our first release was in November of 2018, so it hasn't even been a full year of releases. But man, it has just been a, I don't know what you want to call it, avalanche, snowball, hurricane, just something that's very disruptive but also amazing. It's been a challenge, but it's also been a tremendous, there's been tremendous feelings of accomplishment, and to watch the success of some of these authors, most of these authors, has just been a beautiful thing to witness. And I'm excited to be a part of it. I'm proud to be a part of it. And that's it's yeah, it's been about a year since we decided that we're going to do this thing.
Well, I remember, Steve, in the beginning, you guys were really positioning yourself to be this boutique publisher that was going to really pick some of the best of science fiction, fantasy, give them proper releases like that a lot of indie authors will never get to see by taking this sort of hybrid stance between a big New York publisher and definitely between an indie author and that scene, while keeping the freedom of the indie community and bringing some of the depth and breadth that only a big publisher can offer. And you guys started that way, have had some amazing releases, but your roster has grown, I think, probably bigger than you ever imagined. What do you think?
There are times when Rhett, Bruno, and I look at our roster, and I want to grab the paper bag and breathe really heavily into it. Of course, I would never want any of the authors to hear that, though they are hearing it. We've been able, you know, Rhett and I fulfill – we complete each other. It's a beautiful thing. We just have the opposite skill sets, and I know that I could never do this on my own. I don't believe he could do it on his own. We've been able to kind of combine forces and create. You mentioned positioning ourselves. We had a dream to do this before a year ago. So I say that we decided to do it a year ago, but the reality is we started talking about it about 2 years ago, but we weren't positioned to do it yet. We wanted to be able to do a few things. We wanted to prove that we could sell our own books with success. Rhett had just come off of some really catastrophic traditional publishing deals that just – really, I don't know, wrecked him. I would let him talk about it more than me. I had been going through some things at my day job that I just wasn't happy with, and then ultimately it ended. So that's what when we finally got to that point, we're like, well, you know what? We've been successfully writing together, and our books have been doing fairly well. And now we've positioned ourselves with Audible Studios and some of these bigger audio publishers where we have really great relationships, and we have personal relationships with some really great top-tier narrators. Our vision was always big releases simultaneously releasing with audio. That's what we always thought. This is how it has to be done. And – you know, we started off kind of small with a few authors that we knew had some tremendous talent, and it's just from that point grown to, yeah, this huge roster of authors that we have a lot of faith in and that we believe in. And it's people, a lot of them are people that you just never have heard of. They're not in any of the communities. They're not in the circles that I think you and I have run in over the years. They're people that a lot of times have no idea how to sell a book, but they know how to write a book. Authoring, Hank, you are an author, and a lot of people who are listening to this are authors. Authoring, writing books is one thing. Being the guy who sells the book is another thing. And I think a lot of times authors go, well, I know how to write a book, and then Amazon makes it easy to just put it on Amazon. But how many failures after failure after failure do we see with people that don't know how to release a book? So we said, okay, traditional publishing – now, if you've ever heard me talk, you know that I'm actually not against TradPub. I know that it's kind of the hip thing to be against TradPub in the indie community, but like you, Hank, I support the writing process.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
I love publishing. I love writing.
We love our TradPub brothers and sisters.
Absolutely.
There's a place for everyone.
Do they do everything correctly? No. Does indie do everything correctly? No. But what Rhett and I have talked about over the years was like, well, what are they doing right? What are they doing wrong? What is the other side doing right? What are they doing wrong? How come nobody has tried to really combine this yet? And so that's when we became a hybrid publisher, where we said, okay, so what people need is they need to have their really good books recognized and then have the financial backing of a publisher to market it properly, to get good book covers, to get good editing, to get the books in front of the people who buy books. We went, it doesn't sound that incredibly difficult. Let's make it happen.
Right. And you guys are. You guys are consistently launching books at the top of the charts, selling like crazy. Audio, you mentioned, is massive this year. Last year, we've really seen a swell of people interested in audio. And we're going to be playing audio clips from a number of Aethon releases all through the month. Really, we're going to highlight tons of them on the show, so listen for that. But what do you think is going on with audio right now? Why is this market just exploding?
Well, I listen to somewhere between 150 and 200 books a year. I could never read that many with my eyeballs. I could never find the time to do that. I think that the big driving force behind audiobooks this year, last year, the year previous, I heard it said recently that we're all in competition with one another, and the competition is who is the busiest. And it was a joke, but it was also the truth. You know, you meet somebody, you haven't seen them in a while. You say, hey, man, how are you doing? I'm so busy. And then the other guy's like, yeah, me too. I'm so busy. Yeah, I work 60 hours a week. Oh, I work 70 hours a week. Really? Oh, I worked 80 hours a week last week. And it's just like this competition to see who's the busiest person. I've got two kids in soccer and one kid in baseball, and I've got to be there at the same time. And it's just like everybody's so busy that reading – is really a luxury that most people, I don't think, can find the time to make for themselves. But you're driving your kid to soccer practice, you're driving an hour to work, you're on the train, whatever. During that time, sure, you could be looking at your phone reading an ebook, but I find that – well, not if you're driving. I hope not. But if you're on the train, if you're driving, you just throw your ebook, your audiobook on, and you're now reading a book. Recent studies have shown that there's no difference in the brain between reading and listening to a book. It's the same process. So that's what I believe. Everyone's so busy, they want to read, but they don't have time to read, so audiobook has filled that gap.
Well, Steve, we've done more than 700 shows on this podcast, and I've collected lots and lots of stories from authors about their process and their also – also their journey to becoming who they are. And invariably, a lot of people have stories. It becomes a badge of honor in a lot of cases to collect rejection letters and to you know, to survive the process of being found. You guys have, like you mentioned earlier, discovered a lot of authors that are doing amazing work but just don't have that reach. What's some of the criteria that you look for in an author?
Oh, that's a great question. We mentioned some of the downfalls of traditional publishing, and one of those downfalls is that they have a limited number of slots that they can fill with authors and with book releases throughout the year. That is true for us as well. So, I mean, don't misunderstand. It's not like we're just piling up books and throwing them out there and hoping they stick, but it's a lot different when we don't have any illusions or disillusions about how we don't believe – maybe I shouldn't say this publicly, but I'm gonna. We don't believe that all these review sites help you. We don't believe that paying hundreds or thousands of dollars to get people to review your book are really doing anything to help you. We don't believe that we've got to send out a bunch of physical ARCs to a bunch of different people. We don't believe that we've got to be in Barnes and Noble. We don't believe that we have to have banners and stickers and bookmarks and mugs and like all of those things that traditional publishing are clinging on to. Paying to get awards, paying to, you know, be not to, you understand what I mean. Paying for submissions, and they say that they're free, but they're not really free, and all of those things. That is such a financial drain that is very unnecessary. So we don't have as limited a position with these authors. So we don't need what's going to fit the social climate at the moment. We don't need the author that is the most marketable or the most sexy looking, or we don't need the book that's just going to change the world because it's going to be on every Barnes and Noble bookshelf. What we need are the quality sci-fi fantasy authors of yesteryear before everyone was doing it. What we see in these authors are that they're telling a great story that people will want to read. You know how many books get rejected that are phenomenal stories that people would love to read, but they're not marketable in the way that Big Pub needs them to be?
Hundreds of thousands, I would imagine.
So a lot of those, you know, we don't require agents for submissions, although we accept agented submissions. So we get a lot of authors that go, I don't really know what I'm doing, but I wrote a book. And then we read it and we go, oh, this is really good. It needs a little help. You know, but with TradPub, they want something that's virtually ready to go out the door. They don't really want to spend a ton of time going through the editing process. We don't care about that so much. We have some phenomenal editors on board that are able to look at a book that has promise and go, yeah, we can help make this better.
Well, what we've seen, Steve, and talking to a lot of authors who have been in publishing for, you know, a few decades, is that I'll take a prime example would be Terry Brooks. When he published the first Shannara book, it was really the third book that took off and really made his career. Mm-hmm. And there is not a publisher today that is willing to take a three-book risk on someone to build an author the way that Del Rey did with him. And it doesn't exist anymore. Enter Athon, who is looking for people that you can shepherd and that you can help reach their potential, and it's really refreshing to see kind of the true spirit of sci-fi publishing coming back.
We love to see an author who has no following start to gain a following. We love to see it's sometimes hard to watch an author who has just poured months and months, maybe years and years into the books, and then no matter what's done marketing wise, it just doesn't break through. And you know, there's so many reasons for that. It just depends on what books are being released along with those books that week and that month. And you know, you could put the same amount of marketing power behind one book and behind another, and one will go nuts and the other one won't. And it's not really about the writing. It's hard to figure out sometimes what that is, but the reason I'm even saying this is because it's hard to watch an author that's put so much into it not sell tremendous amounts. But the way we look at it is they started their foundation. They've begun to lay the foundation for the next book or the next book series, and now they have fans. This is the only industry that I could think of in the world that just expects sort of overnight success. You've spoken to a lot of authors that seemingly have overnight success, and then they'll tell you, oh, you didn't see what actually
– Exactly.
You have no idea what I've been going through for the past 10 years. But the masses don't see that. It was like that in the music industry as well. You know, when I was touring in the music industry, you'd get these guys that just all of a sudden show up, and they're like, no, we didn't all of a sudden show up. We've been playing skating rinks for the past 8 years. That was me, right? Like, we were playing skating rinks, and it's just like, finally we hit it. Finally we did something that mattered. But in the publishing industry, you know, we think, oh, the first series has to just blow up. No, it doesn't. It just needs to gain some steam so that your next series will do a little bit better. And then your next standalone will do a little bit better. So I love authors, man. I just love seeing them find success.
Well, the very best science fiction and fantasy is coming out of Aethon right now. I truly believe that. Before we go, Steve, you guys chose from the very beginning to focus on sci-fi and fantasy. I know you and Rhett both very well, and I know that you are both passionate about science fiction and fantasy. Why does science fiction and fantasy matter in the world? Why is it important to put these kinds of stories out there?
Well, you know, there was a book that I read recently. It was called The Amazing Stories of Quantum Mechanics. I believe I got that title right. And
great cover, by the way.
Yeah, man, the cover was so cool. And of course, I'm a cover guy. That's one of our big things for Aethon Books, is if you don't have a good cover, your chances of selling a book are not very – there's a reason the phrase don't judge a book by a cover is a thing, right? I do that. I don't even care what the description says of a book. If I like the cover, I'm like, I'll take it. Why not? I mean, it's art. I love art, right? So – this book, Amazing Stories of Quantum Mechanics, what this author did was he tried to teach the basics of quantum mechanics and quantum theory by using science fiction. He was a science fiction and comic book junkie, and he really just combined all of those things. And he gave all of these tremendous Jules Verne. He used Jules Verne as the example a lot in talking about things that he developed within his books that 3 to 5 years later became things in our reality. I remember Orson Scott Card wrote Ender's Game, which to me is one of the greatest science fiction stories ever told. I love that series. I love that book. I even love the movie, although it doesn't come close to the books. It's a phenomenal movie. It's so exciting. He had the tablet, literally the iPad or the, you know, whatever in the Ender's Game series decades before Steve Jobs and Apple came up with the idea.
You wonder where Steve Jobs got the idea from.
Right. And whether he did or not, like, we look at science fiction.
It was in our consciousness then.
Yeah, man. It's like the reason sci-fi is so important is because it gives people hope for what the future could be. You know, dystopian stuff, maybe not, but maybe that gives a warning of what the future could be, right?
Right.
And in fantasy, it's like it brings you back to the good old days, right? I remember my mom always talking about how she wishes she lived in the Wild West, and I think to myself, you couldn't do without a shower and a hairdryer to save your life, right?
But there's something in us that yearns for
that. There's romance in it. There's so much romance in the thought of, like, living in the days of Middle Earth or one of those worlds that so many phenomenal fantasy authors has created. It's just there's a reason it's called fantasy, right? I mean, it fulfills the fantasies. We get to be the hero who slays the villain and saves the world. I believe that that's vital to human nature. I was a pastor. I still am a pastor. People ask me all the time, how can you be involved in an industry that creates distraction from your goal of bringing people to Jesus and all of these things? And in my mind, I go, we're not creating distraction. I mean, Jesus told stories.
Right.
Right, he told parables and he led people by telling them stories. He was one of the greatest storytellers ever. And we have this tremendous opportunity to, I don't know, enrich someone's life through storytelling. And so for me, sci-fi and fantasy has a special place that genres like romance and historical and all of those have their own special place as well. But sci-fi fantasy is for dreamers. It's for visionaries. It's for people who believe that a future could be great, or they want to be a part of keeping the future from becoming something horrible.
Well said. Well said. Steve, thank you for coming on and talking story with me and highlighting Athon Books. I'm proud to have you guys as friends, proud to have you guys as show sponsors, and keep doing good work that you're doing.
Thank you, Hank.
Before we get into today's interview with Brian Manzer, we're going to play an audiobook clip from his brand new book, Captive Embers. Take a listen, then dive into the interview I did with Brian just a few days ago. We had a great time. Thank you for listening.
Location: Lakshmi Colony, orbiting the gas giant Belia, Cervantes' star system, 50 light years from Earth, 4380 AD. Standing outside of the Coriolis Cafe, Commander Rafe Hastings drew his leather jacket tight and wheeled his shoulders to unknot. He pictured the beaming faces of his raven-haired wife and daughters. He considered that perhaps his wife, Geeta, was right, and he needed to quit playing spy. He made a thoughtful noise as he opened the restaurant's door. Like most places in the 100-kilometer-long cylindrical colony, the cafe exuded the stench of decay. Worn tables wobbled on legs missing half of their rubbery pads. The seat's blue cushions bore questionable brown stains. A formidable mix of spices and fetid scents wafted from the kitchen, or maybe that was still the air in the dank place. Rafe found his informant in a back corner booth. Every aspect of the corpulent ex-mafioso evidenced a life of self-indulgence, from his puffy eyes and greasy hawk nose to the scruffy jowls dragging down his sallow face. In contrast, Rafe possessed dark skin and a tall fitness trainer's physique. Despite a pre-mission surgical makeover, he retained a lantern jaw, mocha hair, and dark Punjabi features that blended with the local populace. Over the room's percussive music, Baylor said, "You took long enough to get here." Rafe suppressed a frown. 2 months prior, Baylor had groveled after seeing Rafe's footage of the dock worker stealing goods from Lilith's cartel. That was only a fraction of the dirt Rafe had on the man. Rafe slid into the bench across the table. "Your safety is a priority. I had to wait until I was sure you weren't followed." He plucked a menu. "What's edible here?" Baylor sneered.
"That raid your people made on Sundar Colony has them searching for the leak."
Rafe raised his eyebrows. He leaned in. "Do they suspect you?"
"Of course they suspect me. They suspect everyone now."
"That's a good sign," Rafe said.
"Yeah, sure," Baylor said. "They don't know it was me yet."
"You did well with that info drop. Earned that bonus. I take it you brought something." Baylor folded his arms and said,
"I want more money."
"Oh?" Rafe's brow furrowed.
"What I found out this week is worth 100 times what you're giving me. Once you've met my price, I want out."
Rafe strangled an urge to laugh. "Baylor, you're already making a killing. Play the game, and Lilith need never know about this." Baylor's face darkened.
"Why won't you Myconians leave us alone, huh? Belia isn't your part of the system."
Rafe shrugged in sympathy. "You know what they say? Blame the wardens." Baylor sniffed. "One could always blame them." "I get the frustration," Rafe told Baylor. "I don't want to be here either, but I can't let you go yet." Baylor opened his mouth to retort when a smiling waitress arrived with a glass of water and placed it in front of Rafe.
"Get you anything?" she asked.
"I'll need a few minutes," Rafe said.
"Take your time."
Once the server left, Rafe said, "The deal stands. Keep feeding me cargo box numbers for my associates to chase. Give me something to explain how Lilith's cartel is taking over everything, and we'll see about cutting you loose." Baylor grinned as he slid an envelope across the table and said, "Here's the report of what I found." Rafe lifted the flap and drew a piece of folded paper. Scratchy penmanship littered the manila surface. He held it up to ensure that the camera and his shirt button relayed the contents to his AI assistant, James. Before Rafe could finish reading the first word of the top sentence, the computer had analyzed the letter.
"You're not going to like this, sir," James said into Rafe's earpiece.
Rafe's shoulders bunched up as he read. Rafe groaned. Somehow, Lilith had gotten her hands on Arbiters. a special type of AI that cost more than the annual industrial allotment for a dozen colonies and allowed humans to mount heavy weapons on and against habitats. Without them, space combat was restricted to exchanges between warships. Even ground troops couldn't lob anything more powerful than an 80-millimeter mortar. Feeling Baylor's intense gaze, Rafe calmly laid the page down. Interesting, if true. Do you have proof? Baylor slid across a black device. Rafe recognized it as one of the micro cameras he'd given Baylor at their first meeting. Its sapphire lens housing trailed a gossamer filament to a mini-computer wafer.
That's your free sample, Baylor said.
The man relaxed into his chair, a finger tapping his left breast pocket. Rafe saw the tip of another envelope poking out.
What you'll need to track some of the rest is in here. I've hidden the other recorders away, so behave yourself.
Rafe connected the miniature camera to his wrist pad. Data poured through the link to James. After a few seconds, the memory wafer erased itself. Rafe fixed Baylor with a stony glare.
My associates will be checking this. If you're lying to me,
James said in his ear.
Sir, I think he's telling the truth.
Rafe's skin crawled.
How long have you known about this, Baylor?
Almost a week.
Why didn't you call me sooner?
If Baylor's report could be believed, some of the items had already left the colony.
Baylor flashed his teeth. So you wouldn't have time to haggle, of course.
What have you done?
My price is 10 million,
he said, folding his arms and leaning back against his chair. Rafe willed the corners of his mouth to inch upward.
Be reasonable, Baylor. I'm sure you wouldn't want me to give the police footage of you screwing those 13-year-olds at the pleasure houses.
Before Baylor could lift his jaw, Rafe heard James's rising voice.
Sir, there's...
The line burst into static. A second later, it cut out. Rafe glanced at his wristband. Its no signal icon pulsed. He shot to his feet, adrenaline pouring into his system. He snatched the paper with its secrets and hauled Baylor up by the collar. Rafe drew his face close and whispered, "We've been followed." Baylor ceased struggling. His eyes bulged.
"What? How do you..."
"Look around," Rafe growled. Several diners wore irritated expressions. They tapped at their earphones, wrist pads, and handheld devices in vain hopes of reconnecting to the net. Someone jammed the cellular frequencies at the exact point when an eavesdropper might have decided everything of interest had been heard. Rafe snarled at the quivering fat man.
"Where's the bug? They must have planted one on you."
"I changed before coming," Baylor said. "I'm clean."
His voice didn't sound so sure.
Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm super excited to have my friend Brian Manser on the show with me. He has a phenomenal book called Captive Embers. It's an intergalactic military sci-fi adventure story, and I love this book so much, Brian, and I love that it is a little bit hard to categorize because it's military sci-fi, it's kind of space opera, and it's a great adventure story, and to top all of that, it has really great characters. So welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. You are so kind, Hank.
Well thank you. But before we get to talking about all that, we begin each show with the same question. And that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
That goes back to when I was about 14 and I read through the Robotech novelization series. Just ate that thing up. And it was shortly after that I decided, I want to write my own novel. And I remember telling the kids at my evening Wednesday night Bible class, I'm going to write a novel, and that was something I became known for. Go figure, it would take me almost 30 years to complete it. But
so were you a big sci-fi fan before that, or did this kind of crack the code for you?
Yes, I'd been a big Star Wars and Star Trek fan. Some of my earliest memories are of watching the animated Star Trek and seeing Star Wars in the movie theater.
Nice. Some people are diehard in one camp or the other. If you had to choose Star Trek or Star Wars, which side would you fall on?
Oh my goodness, I really cannot choose. I've loved both franchises and hated parts of them as well. Not a big fan of the latest movies or even the prequels, but since my kids saw them, I have to like them because he enjoyed them, so it helped out.
There is a generational thing that's going on that I've
There is.
noticed, that that our generation are typically not very keen on the new ones, but yeah, my kids are a little the same way. They really didn't care for the last one, but I think that's kind of across the board.
I think a lot of it is that when you get older, you see the flaws more easily, and your standards are higher, and there's that nostalgia factor all coming together for that perfect storm of criticism.
Yeah, well, and the nostalgia factor for sure, and you can't deny emotional attachments that people have to stories, and when you
Yeah,
start
that's
messing
true.
around with something that people love so dearly, it can be pretty treacherous. Well, speaking of reboots, what do you think of the Star Trek reboots?
I have not seen even a trailer for Star Trek Discovery. I don't plan on
What about the movies?
the movies I enjoyed.
Yeah.
I liked, of course, now they're all rather old, aren't they? The last one was in 2016. So the Kelvin verse is pretty much dead because they couldn't agree on, I think it was salary for the actors is what I think made it fall apart. But I thought they had fun with that, and they kind of played it out by the last one, I would say. Although I would have been happy to see another. The Star Trek Picard, I'll have to watch. I'll have to suck it up and pay my money to CBS and watch it, darn it, because that one's just too awesome to at least pass up a chance, to give it a chance. And since I'll be paying for it, then I'll probably take the time to try out Discovery and see how well that does.
I watched two or three episodes of Discovery, and I didn't hate it. I just didn't really care about it, and I think maybe that's worse. Is that I think there are people that have warned us about being lukewarm, but there's something about just kind of being in the middle of it. Like, it's okay, it's pretty, but I just don't know that I care about it.
That sounds like the death knell to the series for me.
Right.
That's what happened with Enterprise.
Exactly. Just people just didn't. If you don't care enough to hate it, that's a pretty bad place to be. But
I felt really bad for the helmsman of the Enterprise because I can't even remember the guy's name. They just never developed the character well enough.
yeah, that's pretty bad. That's pretty
He
bad.
deserved better.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. So at 14, this Robotech series just set you on fire. Can you put your finger on what it was? Because you said you'd been a sci-fi fan all along, but there was something about this. Can you put your finger on what it was?
That epic sweeping feel, that idea of there being these huge battle fortresses and space wars, and the characters having those relationships. At that point, you're starting to notice girls for the first time, and then realizing, oh, hey, there's this whole world of good guys and bad guys, and you want to be a part of that. You want to dream with that and make something that is awesome like that. Rick Hunter and his love story with Lisa Hayes, and then having that whole thing with Min May trying to figure that out, and then losing Roy Fokker, spoilers. Yeah, there was a lot to what was a young adult story. It was a really, I think the good word for it would be audacious story that they had pulled together from three different anime series. And I saw that, and I wanted to do something like it. And I that was where I realized I was cursed.
Did you start trying to write there? I know you said that
Oh
you,
yes.
yeah. So
Oh
what kind of
yes.
stuff were you writing?
I have the evidence still. It was terrible, and it will never see the light of day
Of
until I'm
course,
dead.
of course, of course. But
Yeah.
everybody has those.
Everybody has those. Yeah, I you know, would try to write a few times over the years in my teen years. And then I inevitably got distracted by other stuff. But then the internet came along. This, you know, this was me dawning in 1990 was where I decided I wanted to write. And I'm, you know, at the same time watching the Next Generation episodes and enjoying DS9 as it kicks off and then to Voyager. And then I go to college and then I get introduced to the internet, and there is, it's still out there. Go figure. It was a really fun club when I was in it. Alt.starfleet.rpg. It's one of the oldest, if not the oldest, online role-playing game for Star Trek universe. And I spent about a decade off and on writing in that group and kind of cut my teeth writing on that team. Just, you know, basically trying to pull a story together and do filler scenes, just having fun. And I ended up writing a book's worth of material that I pulled together so I can. So when people say this is my first book, I kind of have to go, you know, I did write Sarah's story over the course of 2 or 3 years in conjunction with a couple of other people. But it absolutely sucked, and I'll never let you see it. It was awful.
During that time of writing, you know, just purely for fun, mm-hmm. do you feel like that time was important to where you are now? I don't think that we put enough emphasis sometimes on the joy of writing, you know, especially when we start talking about publishing, and, you know, it becomes a whole lot like real life, you know, and sometimes just the joy of it, you know, does more for our creative person. Do you look back on fondness, look back on those times with fondness?
I do. I don't think my family does. It was rather obsessive at times, just because, you know, you get involved in the characters and you want to, well, what's the next thing that's going to happen to this person? And you keep, you know, pushing that cursor forward, and, you know, eventually you have yourself, oh, okay, so this is where this relationship is going, and this is what's going to happen to these two people, and, oh, this is awful what they went through, and how are they going to cope? And it's time for a cool, you know, space battle scene or a running gunfight or something like that. And just learning how to write people, for me, that does not come easy. It just simply does not come easy for me to put myself into the shoes of folks and build the character and understand where they're coming from, what their motivation is. And so that's why it was such a kind thing flattering thing for you to say that the characters are great and that you connected, because my goodness, I had to work darn hard for what you got there. I had some friends give input on it, and there were a lot of rewrites. The folks at Aethon Books are just amazing. Rhett C. Bruno and Steve Beaulieu, and how they helped other friends of mine who are you know, gave little things that, like David Keel and Steve Apple, Kelly Starks, you know, they gave me little things that helped kick characters off and helped them make them what they were. It was a wonderful experience. Amazingly frustrating to write that first novel.
So the book that we have now, mm-hmm. Captive Embers, this story has been in the works for quite a while. But before we get into the book itself, what have you been doing as your day job? You know, we all have bills that we have to pay and families to raise, and writing doesn't always get us to that point in the beginning. So what have you been doing all along with yourself during the days?
I work full-time at a Fortune 500 bank in their executive office, fielding complaints about and inquiries about mortgage issues, both in the origination and servicing side. I think I called it kind of tongue-in-cheek, working the glamorous life of a top-tier customer service agent, which is what it is, and it definitely keeps your mind working, because it's all about researching and all about, you know, how do I, you know, help reestablish this relationship with our customer. So there's a lot of empathy that, you know, has to go into that, and that leads over some to my writing, I think.
Problem solving too, I would imagine.
Lots of problem solving, a whole lot of research, a whole lot of fact finding, and that's good because my story was meant to always be a, not exactly a hard science fiction novel, not like The Martian by Weir, which the first chapter of that, or the first hour of listening to that, thank goodness it was R.C. Bray, because it felt like I was listening to a lecture, but oh my goodness, I was just marveling at how it still kept my attention. And I don't have that talent. Andy's got that. I bow to him. I'm not worthy. A few others are like that, where they're able to pull all that together.
Andy's been on the show a couple of times, and he's like the science teacher that you always wanted,
yes,
but your school was never cool enough to get.
yeah, I suppose so. I had some good science teachers, though. What was the other side of that? Oh, I lost my train of thought. Darn it!
I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that's fine. It was Andy Weir and hard science fiction. So sometimes I try to I put in, you know, these descriptions that are kind of going into that fine detail of what's going on. A little bit of a slow motion scene out of, say, a Sherlock Holmes, where you know there's great detail as to what's going on with this poor victim. And, deep dive a little bit into the technical detail of what's going on with this explosion that's ripping apart your ship. But I have to sprinkle that in. It cannot be one after another. It cannot be every single chapter. Otherwise, even I get bored. And when I get bored, I know that my readers are probably getting bored.
Right. So what's the origin of this story? A lot of us have these pet projects that we've kind of carried around for a while, and you know, with these worlds and characters, and this seems to be one of those stories for you that's kind of been growing and growing and growing. What was that kernel of the original idea?
That original idea was a kind of a realistic Robotech kind of a saga. And also there was the idea of, some far-flung galactic adventure like out of Star Trek. And I ended up listing out what I wanted in the story and what I didn't want in the story. There aren't any transporters. There are at present not even any aliens. There's no time travel. There's no faster than light travel. It's meant to be a potentially realistic place that humanity could end up being. And it's rather horrifying in that prospect. But the idea was I definitely wanted there to be space battles. I wanted there to be space marines. And I wanted there to be love story. And I wanted there to be... this, that, and the other that finally all came together, and oh my goodness, how many drafts and false starts that the story had. I think that there were originally four different chapters that I'd originally crafted as being the initial chapter, and I don't think any of them survived to the final version as the first one. A few of them even got cut, but a couple of them are in there.
Now, what about Rafe? Has Rafe been with you from the beginning?
Rafe is initially a character that Steve Apple came up with. And Steve Apple's a fine writer in his own right. He's only published one book that I'm aware of. But Rafe was a character that he lent to me from our alt.starfleet.rpg, ASR days is what we call them. And... you know, just this undercover guy, and I took him and made him my own, built him a little this way and that, because he had been something else in the stories that rewrote for the USS Lexington. And, you know, he ended up being this family guy who's got a wife with a dark past to her name, and, a couple of children that he's trying to protect, and you know, he's a painted in the first book as a very upstanding, earnest and tenacious guy. And, you know, the hero that you can aspire to be.
When you originally set those rules for yourself, like this is, it's going to be a world with no faster than light travel. And it could be real if we just played out our human advancement, you know, that where we are. Did you ever find yourself in a place where you were like, man, I wish I could just hyper jump, you know, or something like that? Do you ever bump up against your own rules?
I bump up against the rules all the time, but hyper jumping has not been one of them yet. What I struggle to do is respect scale, to respect time, how long it takes to get things done. Your other question was, what else do I do with my time? I'm also Army National Guard. I'm a captain here in the 2nd of the 34th Infantry Brigade Combat Team. And in that, I've spent a lot of time in the logistics cell. So I've spent a lot of time understanding and learning and having my head beaten over by what I don't know about how things work out. Some axioms I've learned are their tactics are just an extension of logistics. It's the final delivery of the product. And it just happens to be the sexy part of it. The rest of it is the hard work of getting the bullets from, you know, the manufacturer, and you could even go further back than that if you wanted, but from the manufacturer up to the front line. And the keeping things realistic, keeping things believable, and having an explanation for how things work in the back of my head, if not on paper, is something that I had to go into a great deal of work for. Kind of all that, Watney from The Martian, but without going into quite so much of the math on paper, because that's not the genre that I'm going for. And, you know, it was funny to me when I had somebody give me a low rate out on Amazon and how they felt that there was no world building. And I was thinking to myself, well, you know, if only you read further and if only you knew. Right. I had to go crunch numbers for how many people could fit in the 100 kilometer long by 10 kilometer wide cylindrical space colonies. I had to think about, well, you know, how are these people fed? What kind of life support system do they have? Where's the power coming in? Is it going to be a single cylinder? How are you going to keep it from tumbling? Is it a double cylinder? You know, it just so many little details that come together. And, you know, I really wish I had utilized my friend, longstanding friend Kelly Starks earlier, because he helped me flesh out some of the starships after I'd written the first book, and we're finding, as it turns out, a hydrogen slush is not a very dense substance, so you're just going to have to write that one off as something you hope nobody pays too close attention to, or if they listen to this podcast, at least we'll forgive you for. It's now hydrogen dioxide.
Right. Well, you know, for every one of those reviews where someone's complaining about the world building that you didn't put in, then you're going to have another review of someone that says, it's too technical, I got lost in the weeds, you know, so you just have to kind of nod. Yeah, you just have to nod and say, okay, well, you know, everything's not for everybody.
Yeah, it's a reflection of what their tastes are, and I understand that. That's perfectly normal as we are. As human beings, if you're writing a review of simply what your opinion is, then that's an honest opinion that they didn't like that. I will, of course, never give anybody less than 5 stars ever again now that I know what that's like. But I understand it.
Yeah, that, you know, my rule is if I love something, I'll review it, and if I don't love it, then I'm just going to keep, you know, browsing by, because it life's hard enough.
I'll rate something that I don't necessarily love according to its genre and how I feel it did for what it was trying to do. You know, I may not like Westerns, or I may not like fantasy as much as I like science fiction, but if you've cranked out what I can see as a good story, then I'm going to grade you on that, and I'll give you a good view for it, because your livelihood depends upon it, right?
Right. Brian, this is something that you've worked on for a while. When did it really start coalescing and become the story that it is now?
That process began in 2014. The book started November 2nd, 2011 was its official start date. And I got sidetracked. I got sidetracked some more, and I got sidetracked some more. And finally, I started writing chapters that survived to the final version in 2014, is when that began. Really, it picked up in 2015. And, you know, I'm an incredibly slow writer. I'm getting better and better at it every year. You know, it just sometimes felt like pulling teeth, yanking fingernails out from my hands. And part of the problem was I was going about it the wrong way. You're supposed to write the draft and then go revise it. I was doing it chapter by chapter. I finished the first draft and on my birthday, November 2nd, 2017. So 6 years later, I finished the first draft, and, you know, then do some editing. It was originally 130,000 words. I chopped that down to like 110. And then it got in front of a couple of more friends, and we chopped even more, and then finally got to Aethon, and whoa, let's take out the red marker. And it finally weighs in at just a bit under 90,000, and it's a much better book for it.
Nice. So let's talk about the story. We've kind of danced around it for just a little bit, but we've talked about Rafe. Who is he? What's going on in this world? And tell us about the adventure that we're set up for.
Yep. Rafe is one of what I consider to be three main characters, but really there's several. It's like an all-cast Star Trek kind of a story where you could point to several people as being a main character. But Rafe kicks it off, and he is on a undercover mission in Lakshmi Colony. And the universe that the world that he's set in is the spawn of a disaster that overtook humanity where the transhumans, I'm transitioning over to calling them the Warden Masters for the second book, because that's a little bit more descriptive of them, and trans seems to not be an in vogue name for ascended humans nowadays. So the fall of humanity came along as the Superman, not the Clark Kent type, but the, you know, self-evolved human beings came along. And basically the rule is, don't pick on the nerds. They're going to end up creating Terminators, and they'll own your lunch. And that's exactly what happened to humankind. And this comes out as part of the story bit by bit. And one of the criticisms is that I haven't put enough detail about what happened in there leading up to things. But the world that you dropped in on is the long aftermath where humanity has been exiled a literal 50,000 light years from Earth at a real star system that's been mapped out, and they all live in space colonies now. They are not allowed to even live on a planet or moon anymore, and they are all watched dogged by these robotic monsters called Wardens. So you have, think of these big hulking, not quite Terminators, but I've described them as obsidian shiny shelled biped machines that will make your day a living hell if you disobey the Warden code. You have a lot of freedom as a human being in this world, but you are not allowed to do certain things that violate their parameters of how you're allowed to behave, because they cannot allow human baseline humans to become in any way, shape, or form a threat to the Grand Order. See the big quotes. So nobody messes with them. It's kind of like if you've seen the movie Elysium, where Matt Damon, you know it's a bad day if Matt in space if Matt Damon shows up.
That's right. We're about to spend a lot of money trying to rescue him.
My goodness. And he tries to give some lip to some android policeman and gets the crap beat out of him just for giving him lip. That's like what the wardens are, except you take that to a 20. Skip the 11 and all the digits in between. You mess with them, they are going to make your life absolute hell. You're going to hate it. And that's for the 2 or 3 hours that they take to torture you to death, if your violation is bad enough. There's plenty of in between. But what's going on is, and again, this comes out fairly early in the story, so I don't think I'm giving away too much to say it. There are forces behind what's going on in the human lands, the human colonies. And what they have done is given a mob boss named Lilith some weaponry that she simply should not be able to get a hold of. Not for the fact that it's forbidden necessarily, but that it's should be just simply unobtainable. And the weapon she's got has come to the attention of this Rafe character. He's meeting with an informant because he knows that something's going on with this particular mafia boss that's causing so much trouble in the Lakshmi colony and the Belian planetary system. There's a big gas giant named Belia there. The astronomical community, by the way, did me the gross disservice of naming that particular star system as I was continuing to write the book. What did they name it? They named it Cervantes. What was one of the planets, the main one where all the heroes are from, that where their colonies are from? Rocinante. What's the big science fiction show out right now? The Expanse. Thank you very much. First they demote Pluto, and now they do this to me. Anyways, you can tell I'm prone to sidetracks. Story is that he is needing to find out why this particular mob boss is suddenly rising through the ranks and causing, trouble by, selling weapons and throwing her weight around. And of course, it wouldn't be much of a story if it was, oh, I got this nice information. I'll just pass it on to my superiors and, continue on with my day and I'll see my family in 3 months. No, it's not gonna be that easy, Rafe. Chase is on.
The chase is on. What sets this race into space? What's the catalyst to have us as spacefaring people?
First off, from a writing point of view, I was struggling mightily as I was in development to figure out a reason why we would have space wars, spaceships, battleships in space duking it out, even from a great distance. And I found time and time again that as I tried to come up with a society that had that, I realized I couldn't make one. I realized that every time you come to a point where you're able to solve that interstellar transport problem, you have solved all the world's problems because you have the ability to do just about anything. If you can, people don't understand just how hard it is to get from one star to another. It's ridiculous. And the amount of power required, the amount of engineering expertise, the amount of computing power to be able to run the infrastructure for all the time it's going to take to get to the next one. It's just astounding. We can't even get back to the moon. So, it was the originally the story was titled The Broken Singularity in reference to the technological singularity because you have to go into a technological singularity, which is where you basically have runaway innovation, and a lot of people argue that we're in that now. Runaway innovation where, at the end point is you're no longer going to recognize humans as humans. They're going to be something else. They might be, some of them might have chosen to put their big brains in squids and inside of a tank so that they are more buoyant, and all that processing power has a greater heat dissipation. Somebody pointed out to me that's probably not very likely. Okay, that's fine, but they still might do that for aesthetic reasons or simply because it's for them it's potentially a longer, easier to maintain that body, whatever the reason is. Have fun with it. And, you know, then artificial intelligences, and that was another thing I had to make a decision on, was, well, are they truly sentient? Can you upload a human brain? I decided for the purposes of the story for now, no, but they can still be really, really smart and behave a lot like people. And then, you know, once some small group of people had that much power at their control, they went ahead and just took over the world. And because there were still a few people who were these ascended humans and had still some, you know, sense of morality and empathy, they took pity on the poor baseline human survivors of the war. And for the comfort of the main group of ascended humans, exiled them out to another star system where they had to leave in these space cans 100 kilometers long. And they could still, you know, run their affairs for the most part, still have wars, still, you know, do commerce and so on. But they would only be supported up to a certain population level, and you know they had to behave themselves to a certain extent. They can't even do their own computer programming in the in-depth that you would see people doing nowadays. That would be something that would get you killed. And they're under constant surveillance. The wardens know everything that's going on. There's a camera in every corner of every room, and it's wired up to the wardens, and you're not allowed to tamper with it. And if you do, it's gonna be a very bloody mess once they come in and beat you up. So, you know, that's the world that humans are in. It's a crap sack universe, and they're working with it. And they know that human civilization has fallen multiple times since coming from Earth. They know that there was an Earth. They have some sense of history. Some of the facts of human history have been given to them, but they've also lost a lot over these cycles of humankind having been wiped out. There's a little echo of the Matrix out of that, but they're not in a Matrix, so nobody needs to wonder about that. But what they're in is something at least as bad. They're in a prison. And they have these wardens keeping them. But, you know, for all of that, the wardens are almost a peripheral character. They are there to make the setting possible. They may take up more significance as the series goes on. But they ultimately are simply that roadblock that keeps humankind from being free to repeat the mistakes that the ascended humans have made.
And that we constantly make over and over again.
They get to make those over and over again to a certain extent.
Well, what's fun is, you know, every great story needs a conflict, and it needs a source of tension and a place for people to aspire to their better selves. Or, you know, we needed someone who is aspiring to be their not so better selves. And a situation like this, a scenario like this, is great fodder for lots and lots of story. This is the first book in the series. How's book two coming along?
Broke 80,000 words this week. Of course, you know, as I mentioned before, I have the problem of editing as I go along sometimes, and so I have written well over 100,000 words for the book, and I've chucked at least 20,000 of it. And more will go as it gets back up to Aethon when I'm ready to submit the first draft, I'm sure.
So what have you learned along the way? Because a lot of us have that problem, turning off the internal editor.
I learned that I hate my life.
Yeah. have you picked up anything along the way that helps you to turn that off and just plow through the story?
Oh, Steve Root tells me that a fair amount. just before we came on, I did a sprint writing with a couple of other authors. That seems to help a lot to just, you know, make that decision that, you know what, no matter what, I'm going to just throw something onto the page. I'm going to vomit it onto the page, and then whatever sticks, we'll see what sticks. And for me, that's hard to do because I hate wasting time where I'm, you know, I know that this is garbage and it's not going anywhere and I don't know what to do with it. I sometimes just have to think to myself in Obi-Wan's voice and say, let go, Luke. Trust me. Oh, my goodness.
Well, you know, writers can be a bit of control freaks, you know, and, you know, especially when you've got so much invested in story and characters and setting and, mm-hmm. and it's hard to let go. And, you know, I see people like Anne Lamott, who wrote that book, Bird by Bird, and she, you know, said, you know, give yourself permission to write a really crappy first draft. And, well, that's easy for you to say.
Yeah.
You know, it's very easy advice to give, but when you're at the keyboard, it's not exactly easy advice to take.
Especially when I write so slow, especially when I have so little time to write. That is hard advice.
It is. Well, Brian, I absolutely love what you're doing. I love the book. I can't wait for book two. The book doesn't leave you on a cliffhanger, but it definitely leaves you wanting more. And I think that's what we want. We want to be satisfied and wanting more at the end of it. There's a link to the book in the show notes of this episode. If folks are just learning about you, is there a place online where they can connect with you, Brian?
Absolutely. The WordPress website that I have is Brian Manser. That's my first name, last name, all together, .wordpress.com. And they can, you know, sign up for my newsletter. More easy to find me is through Facebook. I'm usually on there every day. And, you know, most of the time, if I see that you're friends with somebody I'm friends with, I'll say yes. If not, then I might look at you funny. You know, I'm a pretty approachable guy, and, you know, if you're military, you can also find me there, obviously. Please don't spam me.
Yeah. Well, Brian, thanks so much for taking time to come on the show. I'm going to send everybody to pick up a copy of Captive Embers. It really is a fantastic book, and you've done a phenomenal job. So,
and if I may give one plug, Scott Aiello, who is the narrator for the book, he just did a phenomenal job.
Yes, he did.
He was incredible.
Absolutely did. I listened to the audio, and it is top notch.
The accents that he came up with some of these characters, I never thought I would laugh at a torture scene the way I laughed at a torture scene. It was, I called it Whedon-esque. If you've seen Firefly, you'll know of the time that Mal and Wash got tortured. It was like that because it was on paper, it's a very serious scene. But when you put Speedy Gonzalez's accent on there, oh my goodness. It was Antonio Banderas is what I told him to do. I did not realize what that would come out as. It was incredible. But it works. It worked because at the same time, as funny as that was, it's still chilling every time I go back and listen to it. He did incredible accents for the Bellian characters like Lilith and Gita, who is Rafe's wife. Sean was this, I haven't even gotten a chance to talk about Sean and Sarah. I apologize, but, you know, Sean's got this British accent. Sarah is this, Midwest type, American accent. And that also comes from the colonies that they're from. Anyway, had to say just what an incredible job he had done.
Absolutely. So much fun, so much fun. Yeah, if folks listening are not an Audible subscriber, go to audible.com/Hank. You can get a free audiobook and choose Captive Embers for your free audiobook to start your membership. You won't be disappointed. Brian, it's been so much fun hanging out.
Thank you.
We've been Facebook friends for a while, and it's so fun to put a voice and to get to know you a little better. So thanks for coming on the show, and we're going to send everybody to pick up the book.